Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Today we're going to redo a video. And again, if you come in, this is the first time you've ever seen it, then you will not have known of the other version. But I did a video about character development within screenwriting. And then one of our listeners, whose name escapes me, who seems to know a lot about screenwriting, it's great, I'm learning from this person as well, made a good point. And I rewatched it. I was like, man, I went on like an hour and 20 minutes and I just meandered around. So I was, you know, I was sitting there rethinking it, like, man, I should have done this, I should have done that. And when that happens too much, I will go back and redo an episode. So I'm actually going to put an episode in place of the other one so we can keep the ball rolling here. So 105 is going to turn into probably the Age of Robots, and this will come out whenever it's ready. But this particular time, if you're coming through audio, I just want to make a mention, I'm going to create some imagery so that you can see what I'm talking about. Because the other thing I realized when I was done talking, it's hard to follow. Unless you're just a really photographic kind of, or image-based mind. I got a lot of good feedback from it on a personal level, which was really weird. I usually don't get feedback, you know, from people texting me or something like that. But people who don't write at all came to me. And then some people who have, you know, private writing projects. So I think the meat of what I'm going to say is good, but here's what I'm trying to do, just so that you know the difference about this episode versus every other piece of literature that I have personally read. And I'm going to add an extra layer to this episode as per the comment. I think that a lot of character development how-tos are really shit. That's what I think. And I think the reason why I have that opinion is someone says, well, just make great characters, right? How do you write a great screenplay? Well, you just write a great story. Those kind of answers and those kind of moments of guidance are worthless, right? And then if you appear to struggle, you know, these are all bad teachers, right? If you appear to struggle in front of a bad teacher, they just go, well, you know, that person's able to do it, and I'm able to do it, so, you know, you must be stupid. And it's not true at all. Sometimes you need mechanics, some method of approaching what's going on. For instance, I know for a fact that when you get involved with a television show, the pre-existing franchise, and you're submitting scripts, your writing agent gets you in there, they audition you, they kind of bring you in the door. They don't just sit on and say, there's your screenwriting software, knock out an episode of Star Trek. You go through a whole orientation process. What style guides are to artists, they've got a character guide, they've got a backstory, they've got everything figured out, the do's and don'ts of every single character, how they speak, how they don't speak. And again, like I said, if you're coming in, you know, the second season of something's going to go, well, something's already gone two seasons, you're going to have to watch every single episode and meticulously remember every joke that's ever been told, every catchphrase that's ever been repeated, because you're not going to be allowed to write those again. On top of that, they're going to have the formulas for their episodes, right? They're going to have a certain number of minutes for the setup, certain amount of minutes for the or set up for the premise, right? They're going to have so many minutes set up to carrying the story forward and developing all the subplots. And there starts to be a moment in the allocation of minutes where there's a payoff starting to happen. When they made the original Twilight Zones, they were 30 minutes long, which means you get 22 minutes of broadcast time. They had it utterly figured out of how many minutes to go in for the setup, how many minutes for the incubation, how much for the payoff. When should the payoff start happening? They had it figured out. When they went to season four, they couldn't get the formula down. And there's a great series on Netflix, which is called Black Mirror, that's very Twilight Zone-y, and they're going one-hour formats, and I think that they finally realized after the second season, which is only three episodes per season, they're still struggling with the format, with the formula for build-up and payoff. It's a little long. So when they did the third season, they created one giant three-show episode, which I believe is called White Christmas. So I believe that there are theoretical steps that you can take, fairly left-brainy steps that you can take that will get you way past where a lot of the books that I have discussed and some of the great teachings that I've had, because the teachings are excellent But a lot of times it gets stuck in the metaphysical, you know. Again, come up with a great idea. There was an old 1972 album of Monty Python, and there was something where they were faking a radio show for kids or something like that. And Eric Idle, they tabbed to Eric Idle, and they say, you know, how to manage your career in the medical industry or something like that. And he's talking to little kids, and he's all, what you have to do is come up with a cure to something and then get really rich, and then you can retire. You know, just something like, you know. So what I'm going to do is break down some very important steps and get you in a more visual mode with your characters. I find that when people try to memorize everything in their brains, they, unless you are literally just a constant photographic memory kind of person, like I have different levels of photographic memories, but I don't have them for, you know, to-do lists in a way that I can handle a ton of metadata about each node in my brain. Sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. It just depends. But I typically can't hold it over weeks and months. And developing a script is going to take a long time. Typically. If you have something rifling out of you, it's either incredibly bad and you're in a delusion, or you're having that one in a billion moment where it's just perfection, where you're absolutely involved with the universe, right? But every single story on planet Earth comes with characters, obviously. There's a good guy and a bad guy, right? We call the protagonist and the antagonist. Now, for those of you who are writing experts, this is going to be a little bit of a bore fest for you. But here's what I have discovered. Before I go any deeper, I have discovered that writer's block, which, again, I don't think I've ever really had writer's block because I don't think I recognize it as that. If I am stumped, It's for a very small number of reasons. I either have no idea what needs to occur in my story. My story outline is either not typed out or it's starting to fail for some reason. I figured out day and night doesn't work and this scene needs daylight, but I've written it at night, or there's just something missing. I have rushed through my outlining process. Again, I write in four acts. My outlines are 12 scenes per act, so I have 12 times 4, 48 little turns, or big turns, I should say, within my outline before I even remotely think about doing anything else. And then I just keep exploding those until I get into my beats. But either I've got a flaw in my story, or what I've come to realize is, and you know, I recently talked to my mentor on this, and he was like, yeah, it's funny because a lot of people miss this, which is that if your characters suck, if they have no dimension, if they don't really have a deep purpose, if you're executing your characters' lives pretty much as a utilitarian thing, I am here to bring you a box, I am here to do this, you know, I am your co-pilot, but there's no dimension, there's no interaction between the characters, and there's no purpose for them to exist, it's really deep. You will get bored of your own creation, and your internal sensor that says, is this shit or is this good? You're going to start smelling it because it's going to get really bad. Now, the wrong thing to do at that point is to give up. What you need to do is get excited that you have identified the problem. It's just like when you test software. If you find a bug, everyone should get excited to find a bug because that's a bug that, you know, potentially millions of users would have found. And so we are identifying what's wrong. And if you can identify this character that I made is just boring. All right. Well, time to juice him up. And you're God in this world. So being that powerful, you can do anything with that individual. If you can't just dream it up on the spot, well, then go find people in your real life that have been characters. Meaning, like, they're just like that funny guy or that funny girl, and try to figure out who from my real life, if I put them in this position, would be absolutely outstanding and why. You know, little tricks like that. But we're not going to approach the whole thing through some esoteric cloud of what you could do. So I'm here to identify the fact that if you have really bad characters, it's going to cause a problem. So what we're going to do is go in layers. The first task, you know, I hope it's obvious. You should get your script outline done, right? I remember from my first episode 7, There's premise and there's story. You need to know the difference between the mechanical execution of your story, which is, you know, more of the functional explanation of what's going on, versus the story layer, which should be at least two-thirds of what's going on, which is, why does anybody care about your premise? Who's being hurt? What's at stake? And so forth. But the fabric of that second situation, actually both hemispheres of both these things, is character. Are your characters. They are the scaffolding. They are the pillars that hold up what you're doing. And you could just have someone in there holding up part of the story and being a mechanical person, or they could talk and interact and be interesting, right? If any of you have ever dealt with construction, where you've had someone build something for you and you have sort of a work staff around you constantly, it's a very interesting thing to have people inside your space. And, you know, it's the guy that comes and works and doesn't say a thing that feels the weirdest, right? It's the guy that comes in and says, how are you doing? I'm so glad to be here. Hey, did I show you what we worked on yesterday? You know, I got this neat idea. Oh, by the way, my daughter just got into acting school. And blah, 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 blah. And I bought this new car. That's the guy on the construction site that you remember. And that's sort of a metaphor for what you're doing in story. You're having a bunch of construction workers build your story, and they're your characters. And you can have them come there and just lay bricks and give you weird looks or act like a robot. But just think about how that would physically play out in the real world. You'd feel kooky and weird, and you really wouldn't want that guy or girl to show back up because they're just weird, right? Well, we want to build super interesting characters. If they're supposed to be dark, we need to paint them dark. If they're supposed to be light, we must paint them light. If you want someone to be in the middle where you can't read them, then we need to think about that as well. So script outline is going to facilitate the character development process. Now, you could technically say that you only need to have the broad strokes out of your act 1 through 4. I teach 4-act stuff, right? Again, someone who teaches you the second act should be 60 minutes. They're trying to make it too difficult for you. They haven't written a lot themselves. So take the second act, divide it in two. So you get 1 first act to set up, 2 and 3 is the center, and 4 is your finale. But now, the next layer up, we're going to determine who should be the players in your story. And you should fight under every single context, bringing in another character. You should not want to add another character. You want to have the tightest group of Ghostbusters-type characters that will make your story come alive. Because every time you add a character, besides the financial cost of doing so and the pain in the ass of trying to find the right actor for it, which will affect your pitch in Hollywood, right? If you keep bringing in, like, oh, I got 20 guys on a team and they're all important, they're just going to look at you like, oh, we'll give you 4. Go. Your audience has a number of sockets in the brain. The original phone numbers of the world were made 7 digits. Why 7 digits? Because the mind, at least back before the massively fluoridated GMO world, vaccinated world, flu shot world, you could memorize 7 digits just instantaneously. Now, because of cell phones, pagers, we got to everything has its own area code as well. That's why you don't put too many characters in a film. Take Star Wars 1, 1977. Really think about how many super important characters there were. What they ended up doing was they took your brain and they divided it straight down the center, and they said, this is the good side, this is the bad side. You have a handful of good people and a handful of negative people. And everyone else was sort of like a bartender, you know, was it Guido? This is where I'm going to start getting into the diagrams. I want you to take a piece of paper, and I want you to, 8x11 minimum, if you got bigger, use it. And I want you to create on one side of the portrait piece of paper, write your antagonist's name and draw a circle around him. On the other side, closer to yourself, probably write down the protagonist's name and draw a circle around him. This is going to become the diagram of all the individuals that need to exist. Now, most of the time, you have friends on both sides of the fence. People who assist the antagonist, people who assist the protagonist. It could be that your script has no one on one side and everyone's on the other side. Just adjust accordingly, right? But we're going to be drawing a diagram, and the diagram is based on two factors that we're trying to establish. We're trying to figure out what their physical relationship is, first and foremost. Is he a mother? Is she a mother to this guy? If it's a female, is it the father? Is it a friend? Is it a colleague? Is it someone that is an informant to a police officer? Anything that establishes them as a physical connection. We want to start writing other bubbles. Write the name first, then draw the circle around it. That makes it a little easier. And then we want to draw lines between these characters, right? But the first thing we want to establish is who is related to the protagonist and who is related to the antagonist. Now, if you know you have characters that are going to be double agents and ally with both sides, whether it be intentional or accidental, you might want to put them in the center of the piece of paper because we're going to be drawing a line up and a line down to the protagonist, to the antagonist, right? Now, a line, once drawn between two bubbles, has two sides, an up, a down, a left, and a right, depending on what orientation it is, right? We're going to take advantage of this fact in our diagram. This is my invention. I hope you dig it. On one side, we want to write down the physical relationship. How do these people know each other? On the other side of the line, we want to draw the purpose of their relationship. What is the purpose in your story? Because you know that every single character you could ever write about has a ton of friends and family. But they don't participate. Oh, I got a cousin. Sure, I got a cousin. You don't need to draw them on the piece of paper because they're not in the movie. So if you've brought them into your film, the most important thing is how they assist your character. Now, what does that mean? Well, if it's a mother, it could simply be love and support. And that means it's somewhere in your script. That mother is part of the script, and it shows a very key dimension that is related to the controlling idea or the purpose or plot of your script. This is going to be the next level up. This is the part that I missed. It was, but let's stick to physical relationship and purpose right away. Now, you may not have the ability to fill out this diagram right when you started, but you're somehow absolutely sure that a particular character should exist because you've seen it in your head. You've seen the film finished in your head, right? And so you put it on there. Now, what the footnote is, you may not need that character in your script. And if you can simplify the equation of your script, you will be so thankful when you do your pitch into Hollywood or when anyone has to pitch your script. The less moving parts that you have to talk about when pitching a script, the more likelihood you have the chance to succeed, because everyone in the room can hang on to all of the data. Now, remember, when you build a story inside someone's mind during a pitch, you know, the very first question they're going to ask you is, what's your script like? And your definition is, Star Wars meets Excalibur meets Unforgiven. Oh, okay, that's a little weird, but okay, that's the first layer up. Now, tell me about your story in three sentences. Then you get your three-sentence pitch. If they like that, they're like, okay, well, elaborate. Keep going. We're listening. Then you have to build the story. You have to build the characters that are important in their mind very quickly, their purposes, why they exist in the story, and how they interact. And as you get approvals up and up and up and up as you pitch, the very last thing they ever do in a pitch situation is read the script. That's the last thing they do, because think about it. It's on average 90 to 120 pages, and that's a hell of a lot of investment for someone who's running a film studio. Even if it's a subordinate, the subordinate should be reading something that's been vetted better. So here you are, optimizing just like an equation and algebra 2. We could simplify, right? 4 over 4 is 1. 2 over 4 is 1/2. Simplify as much as you possibly can. Every single script on planet Earth has what is called a controlling idea. Now, I'll be the first one to say that I really, really don't like that label. That label was created by a man who is my professor teacher, Robert McKee, McKee. Please buy all of his stuff if you would like to learn the best approach to most things in screenwriting. But I don't like it because it's using two words that aren't typically just immediately Pavlovianly associated with writing, a controlling idea. That sounds so left-brain and so anal and so unintuitive. How about you just say the plot? Right? You don't need anything else. But they try to use controlling idea because what they're trying to say is that this idea that you're coming up with, your plot, controls all things that happen in the script. I trust absolutely every human being to understand that that's what the plot means, or plot. When you have a story, there is one central thrust, a spinal cord of what you're doing, that is the reason why you're doing this. And a lot of us that write the finales first, or at least have them very well outlined before we start building up all of the how-to beforehand, especially if you write mystery, that is the point B that we're trying to get to. Point A is the beginning of the first act, the setup. No one knows what's about to happen. It's about to happen. And then by point B, well, everyone's gone through every single possible growth pattern they possibly could. All the gains have been gained. All the losses have been lost. And everyone is the wiser for it at the end. If your protagonist actually overcomes their obstacle, it is a comedy. If your protagonist fails to overcome their obstacle, it's a tragedy. And tragedies sneak up on you. Any one of you have seen Tron 1, it's a comedy. Because the main character escapes the computer and gets done what he needs to get done. Tron Legacy, released in 2010, is a tragedy. Because everyone loses. The only thing that happens that's positive at the end of that is that Sam escapes the computer. But Sam loses his father one more time. Sam never becomes a hero one more time. I consider that a double tragedy. The reason why I didn't get into the character development as it relates to their decisions under pressure is because I really lamented about that in episode 7. But I think that it's a mandatory piece of the equation. Just one, in case you hadn't seen episode 7, it was a very long time ago, or the rewriting episode. A hero, which is typically your protagonist, even though I would say that, you know, the hero arc within Hollywood has been played up and exhausted so many times that you're gonna, if you walked into Hollywood and say, oh, I got a hero arc thing, it's the Boon, they're gonna go, yeah, you and every other writer on planet Earth, why don't you try to dazzle us a little bit more with some more adjectives and, you know, accomplishments within your plot for your characters, right? Your characters are going to go on a journey. Your main characters. Now, typically, your protagonist exists from the very first page to the very last page. Your antagonist will somehow usually debut within the first act, right? I'm not sure how you could have an antagonist that didn't materialize in the first act. It may not be on the first page, but they're usually going to exist until the last page. Which means everything that you're doing is going to be nurturing your plot, which is the spinal cord of what you're doing, right? It is the driving force of everything that you're doing in your script. And if you visualize this in your mind as a central line, I'll try to draw this, right? A big, thick line up the center of your script. That's your plot. And your antagonist is maybe on the left, and your protagonist is on the right. And they're going to interact and share things that are going to be driven by that plot line in the center. The characters around your main characters are this sort of electron cloud of assistance. Any character that's not part of the protagonist and antagonist central characters are going to have to facilitate and enable them to get through the obstacles that are being presented to them. What's really funny is I saw San Andreas the other day, which, my God, what a bad movie. It's made for like 14-year-olds. Some of the CG is so outrageously horrible. Look at the helicopter scene in the very beginning. Looks like toys. So the rubbling is beautiful. But here's the funny thing. Robert McKee has another term, which he calls the gap. I'll talk about this at length in episode 7. The gap is this, and it's perfectly on point demonstrated in Andreas, right? So if you haven't seen San Andreas, it's all about the San Andreas fault popping really badly, and it pops in a big linear fashion such that Los Angeles gets a tiny heavy duty massive earthquake, and San Francisco gets like 5 or 10x of what happens to Los Angeles. And we have a daughter who's stuck in San Francisco and The Rock and some other woman are the parents, and they're trying to get to their daughter to save her. And there was a point where they tried to use a helicopter. The helicopter had some issues, and so they had to take a truck. And then they're driving this truck on the highway, probably Highway 5 or whatever, and they're trying to get north to San Francisco. And the ground rips open, which, you know, that's more myth about earthquakes than anything else. So this ground rips open. It's the big Hollywood, you know, CG, the big drop-off. But they had to slam on the brakes on their truck, and they almost fall over, of course. But now the characters get out and look down at this gap in the earth. And you realize right away, without knowing, you could be 8 years old and you know, well, they're going to have to find a way to get around. That's actually the on-point example of what you're supposed to do in writing. Your character just needs to get up in the morning and go to the store. And they're about halfway there, and a meteor storm comes out of nowhere. And behind them, a meteorite totally destroys the street and kills God knows how many people. And in front of them, a jumbo jet that was hit by a meteorite up in the sky comes and just plows into the parking lot and right into the store that they had to go to. And everyone's dead on the plane, and, you know, everyone's frying to death inside the store. And now your character is literally trapped between two physical barriers. And again, it doesn't have to be a physical thing, right? But they have to find a way back home, find themselves to safety, figure out if their family's okay. Whatever you set up in that hemispheric cloud is what matters to them, right? So if you put down a mother on that sheet, a protagonist, and you say, on one side of the line you say mother, on the other side you say mama's boy, it just automatically establishes the fact that this gentleman has got mommy issues, right? Well, if meteorites are falling out of the sky, then your mom could be dead already. But he needs to find out, because that's his core in life. He isn't his own man. He bases everything off what his mommy thinks of him. And so if she dies, he loses his identity. So the controlling idea, the plot, is for him to get to his mommy. And every single thing he does for 90 minutes to 120 minutes... it's just not happening the way he wanted it to happen. And San Andreas is the most on-point, gappy script you've ever seen in your life. I mean, every single time they get ahead, the next Breaking Bad thing happens. And it's so obvious. I mean, it's actually a great movie for if you want to really study sort of a juvenile script that will sell in Hollywood. You know, and we need those kind of movies too, honestly. I think we need simple films to... you know, appeal to a simpler audience, I guess, but I'm going to encourage you to go way further. So let me tell you how I approach this next layer, right? So the first layer was to obviously figure out your plot and your premise, keep them separate from each other. What's the mechanical nature of your script? Someone travels through time, someone, you know, has sex with their mother and they didn't know it, you know, I mean, all these crazy things. And then you have, which is not too far off from Back to the Future 2, if you want to get all huffy puffy. And then the next layer up is your story. Why does anybody care? Next layer up are basically, who are all the players? Who's your bad guy? Who's your good guy? And who are all the supporting folks? You could have three good guys, three bad guys. It's up to you. Share screen time. Avengers always has multiple good guys, right? And then it's basically, what actor has a better agent to determine who has more screen time, right? You figure out their relationships, physical relationships. Then you figure out the purpose of those relationships. Why is this person in your script? What is the unbelievable thing they carry into the story that makes them qualified to be there? And then the very next step up is the more advanced layer, which is that for your main character, you need to figure out the yin and the yang between the protagonist and antagonist. I came up with a script idea. It's pretty cool. I was telling my mentor about it, and he said, that's a really good idea. You should do that. But he goes, it was a sort of an unraveling mystery plot. You're essentially seeing all the clues that you needed to see. And my character was obviously getting stopped and trying to solve a particular problem, which was what the plot's based on. It's a female lead. And my teacher basically said to me, he goes, look, I'll tell you what. I've seen this kind of thing, and I've seen it done really, really well. And I've been in debates. I've curated scripts for Hollywood, and what you need to have is at least 25 turns before you get to the end of this film. 30 would be probably better because you'll have some to pick from. And what Robert McKee would call these turns are gaps. Just like in San Andreas, when Rock is trying to just drive up the 405 to San Francisco, the road literally tears apart and he looks down at a gap and he goes, Jesus, I got to do something else. Right? They found a plane and they flew over it. That's what you're going to have to do. And you're going to need to create an outline. So if I were to take his advice, I would get a piece of paper and I would literally create 25 blank bullets. And I would start throwing in there every turn that I had already thought up. And I'd probably only have about 10 or 11. And I would need to create 15 more at a minimum. And then I need to rearrange them. This is what you're going to have to do. Such that it starts small. The gaps that your character runs into are smaller than the next gap, creating a sort of, you know, line chart such that it goes up over time. It becomes more grandiose, more amazing, and sort of has a requirement of suspension of disbelief that is supported by the previous bullet, the previous gap. You know, we've never done this, right? But, you know, imagine taking the movie that you like the most and then take the last few turns out of the film and just cut and paste them and show them to your friend and say, what do you think about that scene? Isn't that amazing? And your friend might just go, well, that's totally unbelievable. Or what's the point of that scene? I don't get it. It doesn't mean anything to me. And obviously, the person's correct because they haven't seen all the gaps and all of the meaning developed over the course of your script. To further the physical model in your mind, because I think this really helps. I think that people that write scripts fluently or books fluently have a physical model in their mind of their story. And it's just sort of a one-to-one correlation. We talk about the center of your story, which is the plot, or what McKee calls the controlling idea. And there essentially are, you know, there's some practice in the good guy and bad guy, and things are happening to both of them. Obviously, your bad guy should be a big player in stopping the good guy from getting what he wants, and vice versa. But now, think about it like this. The nice thing about a human spine analogy is that you have DNA in a spine. And so every single time you create a gap for your character, something that's going to stop the story from moving forward fluently and make your character make a decision under pressure, be innovative, and get around the obstacle. And it doesn't have to be physical. Absolutely mental is the best kind of gap you can find, right? But it must be drawn like a syringe from the genetics of the spine of your plot. It has to make sense within your story. And to the degree you introduce new things, you're going to get accused of something called deus ex machina, which basically means you cheated. You just brought something in out of thin air to save the day. You brought in a character to save the day. When Sam's character in Tron 2 is sitting on the game grid and he's about to be murdered and the wall explodes and then Cora drives in this four-wheel vehicle and says, get in. That's deus ex machina. That's the writer painting himself into a corner and trying to be sort of lowbrow about introducing a new character. They didn't show her pining from the outside, looking in, trying to make sure, maybe even having to kill a few guards to get in there and building up her character a little bit so that we could see that was coming, so we didn't feel like it was an unfair debut of a character. They injected DNA into the story instead of taking it from the plot itself, right? But each gap has to outdo the previous gap. And as soon as you create a gap, and this is part of plagiarizing my seventh episode, but as soon as you go down in the payoff of a gap, and you kind of cut yourself some slack, well, there's a lot of gaps, man. I can't make them all bigger than the next one. That's why you don't get paid. That's why your script doesn't get picked up. Or that's why that particular area of your script leads to a massive rewrite such that you don't recognize what you brought to studios. And that means when you sit in the audience and you've got your mom next to you, your loved one, and you're like, I wrote this movie, and then every word spoken isn't your words, or there aren't your words, right? So we don't want that to happen, right? So gaps are going to be driven by circumstances within the world that don't relate to characters, such as the San Andreas film, right? There's no character that ripped the world apart in California, which created the gap in the highway. Try to be careful writing those kind of scenes. It could be that a particular character that is with your main character and supports your main character simply screws up, falls down running in the forest, right? Whatever it is. And then you have the grand poupah of Gaps, which is your bad guy, your antagonist, reaches over the spine and throws a grenade into their world and stops them for one gap. You must ensure that these things are interesting, that the gap quality that you're writing is not cliche. Imagine I just wrote a horror movie and I do put that woman is running in the forest. There's a man and a woman. They're running from the forest and there's a werewolf coming after them or something. And the man has no problem negotiating the sticks on the ground, the logs, whatever. He is just pure athlete running back from some professional football team. And the woman is just feeble-minded, doesn't know where her feet are, panics under pressure, and she just falls down. And then the main character's got to go run back and get his girlfriend, and now they're both in peril because if I wrote that, it's an utter cliche, and you would dislike the film. You would subconsciously dislike the writer who wrote it, and you would never recommend it unless there's some massive, massive payoff after that. So here's my thing. In the record business, they used to, they used to make albums with 10 songs, like Back in Black, AC/DC. I think it has 10. Whatever the number is, it's perfect. And they were essentially saying, we aren't going to put a song on the album unless it's amazing, which is why that is probably the de facto best rock and roll album on planet Earth. But what happens today? Go buy an average gangster rap album. You got 20, 30 songs or 30 tracks. You get it for $10, $9.99, and you start looking at it, and there's a bunch of 30-second skits or even 14-second skits that if you bought it individually, they actually want 99 cents for that, as if it has any artistic quality whatsoever or ties together the album. And when you buy an album today, no matter what genre it is, you can expect at least 50% of the album to completely suck. And they know it sucks because they're simply trying to milk you out of the other $5. Where if you just bought the four songs that were good, you beat out $4 or $4 and some change. If you maybe $5 if they cost $129 a piece, right? But they have written themselves a blank check, and they've re-engineered the industry and re-engineered our expectations to accept crap. And there are a lot of films out there that are starting to do that, where the gaps are so utterly boring and so utterly cliche. And the artists whom are the writers, us, give up. It's not always the original writer's fault, by the way. It could be the studio head has someone in there that needs to take a piss on your script. And all that means is they want to scent it. Like, they want to be writers, but they aren't writers. And so an executive might get involved and say, well, I did that scene. It's the worst scene in the whole film. But when he bumps his wife or bumps his mother or whatever, or husband, I guess, they want to take credit for something. That happens too. But you don't need to worry about that. So just to review, we have the physical relationship model between the characters and how they relate to the protagonist and antagonist. We have their purpose in their lives. What metaphysical thing happens? What action happens between them? How and why are they in your script? And, the last certification step is, can you delete them from your script? Because you want to. You want to get rid of every character you possibly can. And you might end up being able to combine two of the characters. You can say, well, I had this one character, Jack, and he actually was supporting this person as a best friend, but then I actually have his cousin over here doing this. Why don't I just make his best friend his cousin that? If I think cousin's kind of stupid, let's lift everything I've given to the cousin and give it to Jack. Or Jack to the cousin or whatever. So try to combine and reduce. You don't want to create a Swiss Army knife character where someone is constantly sort of multidimensional to the point where they seem unbelievable. I'll let you sort that out. But the next step up is we have to figure out the map of gaps that are going to happen for each one of your characters so that you can express their internal dimension, which is the next thing we're going to get into, based on their decision-making processes. based on the gaps that you create. Now, imagine, just to give you a sense of this, because what I said in my last version of this episode was that dimension is something that the actors talk about a lot because they have to portray it. But what's really interesting is there's a bunch of industry people that will say, I don't feel like this character has enough dimension. And it's not that they're not completely correct, but when asked back, what would you consider to be dimension? They go, well, I don't know. It just feels flat. And you know what? You don't have to worry about blaming that executive, because that's the exact attitude your audience is going to have. Your audience member doesn't know how to write a movie. They have no idea what a grip is, what a DP is, what an AD is. They have no idea. They just want to give you $15 to have an experience. It's all up to you. It's not their fault that you don't make a good film. And so you can't get all pissy about it. So let's talk about dimension. Robert McKee's big saying is, a hero is defined by his or her, you know, decision-making process under pressure. Now, I want you to take the word pressure and put a pin in that and make sure it doesn't lose your sight. If you want, create a post-it somewhere in your world and write the word pressure, especially when you're doing your gap chart, because that's going to be your key barometer for how to write the gap that you're on. Let me give you an example. Let's just steal some of the characters from Walking Dead. Walking Dead has an opening episode where the world is fine, and then it goes to shit, right? And let's just say we write a scene that is a gap that will happen before the world turns to shit to show you the dimension of a particular character. And then let's repeat a similar situation after. And let's show you the difference of how the audience can feel pressure changes. Right? You are the atmosphere creating high pressure and low pressure for this thing, right? Our character, Rick Grimes, goes into a convenience store. And there's someone in the store that is behaving strangely. All Rick wants to do is go in and get some water, go in and get a cup of coffee, get a candy bar, whatever, and get back in his squad car and go back on his patrol, because the world's fine. But he goes into this convenience store, and there's a young kid who's, I don't know, late teens, and he's really behaving strange. He's got too much clothing on. You know, he's trying to conceal who he is, and he's sort of always jumping around the end caps in the aisles such that when Rick tries to look at him, he can't get a beat on him. And Rick, being a police officer, understands this is a little funny, but the world's good. The world itself is not under pressure because it's a normal thing. So the only pressure in Rick's life is a suspicion that this kid is acting strange. The pressure is localized on this interaction between the two of them. This character, who's the kid, who's in your piece of paper here, who's a temporary one-scene character, has been invented with no relationship at all with Rick. He's just a proximity encounter. Right? And his purpose is to call out how Rick will act under pressure to enforce the law when maybe there doesn't need to be lethal force used. Because everyone else in the room has been evaluated to not be working with this individual. They're wearing normal clothing. They're not paying attention to anything. Even the shopkeeper is pleasantly dazed by a bunch of early morning customers, and he's just making small talk and everything's great, but this other dude's weird. And we make him stick out like a sore thumb. We make him stick out like a black sheep so the audience can see it. The kid is planning to rob the place. And that's what Rick suspects. We get a little reveal that the guy's got a gun. There's a little close-up tied on his waist. And he's about to, you know, he's adjusting his gun in his belt. And Rick starts to reverse the tactic on the kid. Rick starts disappearing out of the kid's mind. Or, you know, starts evading him, starts sneaking up behind him. In fact, visually speaking, in the script, we lose track of Rick. But the kid starts making advancements. We start dedicating action to the kid who's going to come up there and try to rob the whole place, and everyone's standing in line. And in a really cool, swift moment in our script, one of the loose, original gaps is that the kid pulls out the gun. He's about to say, "Freeze, motherfuckers." And Rick comes up right behind him, disarms him fluently, pins the guy down, and takes the gun away from him. He's got a badge on. Somehow now the kid can see it. or whatever. Maybe Rick was going in there before he was loading up on his uniform for the day, or maybe it's his off day. And Rick decides whether or not he's going to book this guy or let him go. But as a little bit of a twist, Rick pins him down way before he gets in line, way before he says anything, and way before anyone knows that there's a perilous situation happening. The gun's a fake, which diffuses the actual intent of this character, of this bad kid. And Rick now makes familiar conversation with the kid, and you find out that kid is someone that Rick has known forever. And he says, you know, you don't need to be doing this. Do you want to be in jail for the rest of your life? This will put you away for 10. What do you think you were going to do with the fake gun anyway? He takes the gun away from the guy. The guy seems immediately regretful. He immediately starts crying quietly and whispers to Rick, I'll never do it again. And maybe Rick hauls him off to his car, takes him to a rehab place or a hospital or something. But the whole thing's diffused, and Rick makes an amazing decision not to incarcerate the guy, not to arrest him, because he's a good guy. And that's the way we see Rick. It pulls out the dimension of his mercy. It pulls out the dimension of his life history. It also reveals a connection, a physical connection with the kid. The kid also reveals his good nature and his suffering. He's in a really bad spot in life. Either he's addicted to drugs and he thinks he's just going to use all the money to buy a big bag of something, or whatever. So that's before the apocalypse. The pressure had a certain level of pressure between the two. You felt it in your heart as this kid was about to do something. We didn't let the audience have exactly what they wanted. We subtracted Rick for 5 seconds to make the audience feel like, oh my God, this kid's going to kill everyone. Where the hell did Rick go? And you find out Rick is someone you can trust. Rick has the game down, right? Now the apocalypse occurs. Very similar situation. Now people are scavenging for food. It's been a year. Rick's had to kill a lot of zombies. He's had to kill a few very aggressive human beings who tried to kill him or his posse or his people or his family. Rick has been changed. We've had a lot of gaps. Maybe hundreds of them. But now he's in the same exact convenience store somehow. And they're looking for something, and that convenience store hasn't had this particular thing taken because no one saw any value in it. So he's in there messing around, and now there's a shadowy character. Maybe it's the same exact character. And the guy, he couldn't deal with life when it was good, and now it's the apocalypse. Somehow he's managed to hide somewhere for a year. And it's this ironic scene where they get to see each other again. They come together. And he's going to now try to take something directly from Rick. And this time, the pressure is up really high because the kid has killed people, you can tell. And Rick's killed people. And so right away, we know that we have two very capable people who have turned to the dark side to survive. And they're gonna mash up heads. You know right away, they're not gonna fire the actor who plays Rick Grimes. So he's going to win. But now you just want to see how creative the writer can be about it and how they can bring out more dimension. And Rick makes the decision in this encounter to kill the guy. But before that happens, he tries to talk the kid down. The kid is just feral. He has no more words to say that make any sense. He says he needs what Rick has, maybe. I need your car. I need your keys. And Rick tries to say, why don't you just calm down and join us? Right? Nope. I can't trust you. There's been a lot of people said the same thing you've said, and they took shots at me. And Rick just can't calm this kid down. But Rick tries. Again, Rick hasn't lost his humanity in this first year. So we see the dimension of Rick hanging on for dear life, trying to preserve humanity and humane behavior. But in the end, the kid draws on him, and Rick has to do a high noon moment, and he blows the kid away. Right between his eyes. The kid has a split second expression on his face of, oh my God, I finally died. The one thing I was afraid of. The one thing he was too much of a coward to do. He dies. And Rick, you see Rick's face, and he literally has tears of anger in his eyes. And he's like, God damn it, you making me kill you. I don't want to kill any more human beings. When asked the questions, how many humans have I killed? I don't want to increase that number. But you just made me do it because you basically made it between me and you. And then we have a moment, a physical moment, where Rick doesn't say a word, but you can see it on his face as he picks over this kid's body and has to take everything that he has because you're not, you know, you don't want to be stupid. Maybe the kid grabbed what Rick wants. And you see that Rick, as he leaves, is just that much more hard. He's lost just a tiny slice of that humanity pie that he's been trying to keep undisturbed. And from that point forward, you know your character is going to be different for a long time. It's going to have to be something very positive in his life to restore that little chunk of reality or of humanity that he lost in this second encounter. The pressure gauge went up. So as you design your gaps, I want you to think about the pressure gauge. And if you want to get anal about it, or left brainy about it, I would recommend just getting a big stack of square post-its, you know, and find a place in your dwelling where you can write your sort of thermometer. You can write percentage numbers. You can even just write low, medium, high, whatever, and try to evaluate. You want to create an Excel spreadsheet, and you got all your scenes that you need, all the gaps that your character needs to do, and you got a column that basically increases the pressure. Whatever works for you, right? But every single turn, every single gap should make your audience, and especially the studios, learn more about your character in a way that they wanted to learn about your character. You know, and I'll give you a real world, I'll give you two real world examples from my own life. One I talked about a long time ago on a different episode, so I'll go extremely fast. I had a friend of mine, he was just more of an acquaintance. He owned a restaurant. I ate at his restaurant all the time. I helped him with his business. It was starting to return, but there was a point in his life where he was $500 short of paying rent. We're sitting at his restaurant early morning, probably 11 o'clock. The customers hadn't been there yet. And he's talking about this, and he's bummed. And I said, I will give you the $500. I'm eating for free anyway, so might as well just give it to you. And he looked at me, and he said, I can get the money for my wife. I just don't want to. But the fact that you were willing to give me probably your last $500, because I was in between jobs at the time, and he knew it, means something to me. It reveals to me that you're a stand-up guy. And I can, you know, I'll be friends for life. And that's exactly what happened. We're brothers now from a different mother, right? One of my friends, he's a celebrity, let's just put it that way, in the music industry. He and I met each other. You know, he doesn't know if I'm a tag along. He doesn't know if I'm, you know, a real guy. He and I went out on an outing for all intents and purposes, sort of like a camping trip with a couple other guys. And our, you know, there were some trials and tribulations on this trip of just physicality and issues with equipment not working right and us having to work together to get it to work right. And going off and doing that together and him seeing that I am the kind of guy that roll up my sleeves and participate in anything, no matter how hard it is, validated me to him that I'm a real guy. He started sharing more of his personal stuff with me, his personal struggles. And I sat there and I listened and I gave him good advice to consider when dealing with these situations. Well, that validated me to him. So we dealt with gaps mutually to define ourselves. There's a lot of cop movies out there where there's two cops together. And it's them working together, supporting each other, getting each other through thick and thin. It's in Saving Private Ryan type movies when, you know, someone falls and they have to run out and save the body. You know, run out and save a guy who's injured. There's Full Metal Jacket where sometimes people sacrifice their lives trying to save someone who's already gone. Because no man will be left behind. These are the sorts of things that should be revealed every time you turn the scene or gap your character's flow up the spine of the plot. Now, typically, what's beautiful about a plot, and this is why I don't like controlling idea, because controlling idea is sort of the metaphysical description of a plot without a physical model in your brain. There is a point A that you start your script at. And then there's a point B where you physically end the script. So you physically start in point A and you physically end in point B. very few scripts on planet Earth physically start where a guy is sitting on his sofa and then he runs off for 120 minutes and comes back to his sofa. If that's the case, hopefully that is a, you know, an unbelievably profound moment. But they still leave the sofa to go get back to the sofa. The snake eating its own tail sort of metaphor, right? And that's your job, is to figure out this dimensional issue with your characters. Now, the problem I also have with teaching any course on character development and simply talking about gaps is that doesn't really physically help you. It's like me saying, think up a really good idea and then I'll make your script happen. And you go, well, how? And that's why I feel like when you physically can see it in your mind, once a character actually is on your character chart and it makes sense, then you will naturally gap your character beautifully. You will naturally create an evolution in their storyline. So I think that, again, to loop back on what I said at the beginning of this episode, writer's block is potentially initially related to the fact that your plot's not that interesting. That the change between point A to point B, the massive gap of evolution in your storyline, isn't that interesting to begin with, which is why when you first start out this process, when you think you have a setup that's worth paying off, you got to write that payoff first, even if it's just an outline. Don't worry about what everyone says exactly, but it's sort of like, you know, someone coming up to you and telling you, you know, let me tell you about this story called The Titanic. Oh, what's that? Well, it's about the biggest ship that was ever built in the early 20th century. They said it couldn't be, they couldn't sink. It was invincible. And on its maiden voyage, it sinks. But somehow, the captain of the ship saved every single person on the boat. Sounds unbelievable, doesn't it? Well, let me tell you how it happened. They all ended up on this weird little island in Iceland or something, right? Now, you might just look at that story and go, I don't even care. It's a boat sinking. It sounds like a big downer to me, even if everybody survives. And so then you say, well, okay, well, I got another script idea. It's about a kid. It's set in the future, but it's actually happened a long, long time ago. This kid's a late teenager who's working on a farm with his uncle, and he pretty much is at a rite of passage where his uncle is sitting on top of him, won't let him do anything to take control because his uncle is very selfish. And this evil empire, who's trying to take over the entire galaxy and rule it, finally gets to this kid's planet. They're chasing a couple androids that have some very important information that could sabotage the entire empire, and the kid crosses paths with these robots through an auction. And because he buys these two robots, which look like washed up old little robots, he gets drawn into this. And by the time the movie's over, that late teenager farm kid ends up using all of his resources, meets all the right people, and he blows up the biggest weapon that the Empire has ever devised, and it's called the Death Star. It is an epic ending. And this kid becomes a hero right in front of your eyes. Doesn't that sound a little more interesting, right? Because when you think about all the variables of a ship going down, well, you're just kind of like, well, obviously a ship gets a hole in it somehow and it starts to sink. And we know how ships sink very slowly, typically, unless it's blown out of the water by a submarine. And then it's just going to be a bunch of save this person, save that person, big boat, life raft. Someone's going to die in that other story no matter what. And then, you know, what's the final act of that? Well, they're all kind of washed up on the shore of Iceland, and you sort of recap everybody's, you know, huggy-feely moments. So you can kind of predict the Titanic before it happens. Now, it is the number one grossing movie, I think, in world history. So James Cameron did an amazing job with that story, which means he's a great writer-director. But if you're starting out, that's not a script that's for a beginner. That's a script for an utter expert. So if you lean over to a Star Wars world, which isn't dramatically easier, but it's got so many variables that you automatically know that when you want to create a hero and create infinite gaps for this person, and you put them in a science fiction world where you can invent things left and right and sew them into the fabric of the universe, which is your story universe, you can give it backstories immediately. You can You can have characters that simply are in the story to say, yeah, the Millennium Falcon's legendary. You're going to ride on that thing? Wow. It's kind of a junk pile today, but I hear it still can do what it does. Oh, and that guy, Han Solo, he's got this really weird Wookiee. He's a really weird hairy species thing. You've never seen him before. He'll get you there, but man, you can't trust him because he's going to show you his dimensional problems with being chased by Jabba the Hutt. Because, you know, a guy's going to show up at the bar and try to kill him. If your characters are flat, then the experience is flat. If you're running into writer's block, it's simply because you need to go back to the spine of your story. Make sure your plot's healthy. Make sure it's interesting. And if you can answer the question, yes, my plot is actually super interesting. The point A and point B, from the very first page to the last page of my script, it's awesome. And I'm just struggling with these pages in between. When you make great characters, they take over the script. And you'll hear this by every great writer out there. In fact, there's a Twilight Zone all about this. I believe it's in the first season. It's the Twilight Zone with the envelopes. But these characters will fight you and refuse to do what you say because somehow, the way the universe is built, somehow they kind of technically exist somewhere in some dimension. And so you're conversating with them. It's not just your subconscious. Trust me. If it was your subconscious, then every writer would probably have a massively infinite growing group of people in your brain. You'd turn schizophrenic at some point, but that's not what happens, right? I had a character in my script I wrote last year, and the character essentially informed me that he had to die. And I didn't want him to die because I had built up a character that I really loved. And I think he was endearing, and I think he's going to be, if the script ever gets made, he'll be one of the main reasons why people like the film. Oh yeah, that guy. I totally love that guy. He's great. Man, when he died, I nearly choked up and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But I fought that character in my brain for 2 weeks, like I was having a conversation with a different human being. And he just kept saying, well, if you don't kill me, your script's going to suck. If you don't kill me, Hollywood's going to kill him. Like, so the studio's going to kill him as soon as you bring him in. And they're going to know that you don't have the guts to do what's right. You don't want to feel the pain of my death. And so you're refusing to kill me. And that was exactly what happened. And so I took a deep breath and I was like, okay, if you're going to die, then you're going to die in some really important way that's going to reveal dimension in the script. And the way that he died was that a person was essentially a spy that you thought was actually good. Now, I revealed to you with clues that he definitely was not a good person. But we thought we'd gotten rid of the guy, and he shows up at the last second, and very logically, and he does a chicken shit kill on our guy, which then devastates the hearts of all of the protagonist's support team and the protagonist himself. Have the guts to do it. So one of the reasons why I'm really pushing these, my particular version of teaching this, because there's plenty of books out there, there's plenty of seminars you can go to, workshops, where people are obviously much more validated than me in the industry. But what I never hear, and what I think happens when you have a mentor in real life, you get to have the metaphysical conversations about the trials and tribulations of writing. You get to say, well, God, you know, I just can't get the script done. I don't even know what the deal is. And your friend digs into what's going wrong with your script, and they dig in and they give you what you need. Now, almost every teacher in the world will charge you money to do that, up to 10 grand to do that. They read your script and they get into it. But, you know, they're trying to get in and out as quickly as possible. So even though you might part with 7 to 10 grand, you may not get really a deep dive. And so we sort of have to stick together to make sure that we talk about the things that are never talked about. There's not a book that I know of, and I own, again, like 20 books on this subject at least, that says, you know, the chapter on you're about to quit. There should be a whole book called Quitting, you know, you're not quitting, or something about, you know, persisting through the writing process and really get at these moments when you've tried to follow all the rules and for whatever reason, you totally understand them. I don't really want writing to become a big rule-based thing with you. But I find out that processes do help in a big way. That's why I like Robert McKee's teaching in his book Story, because he essentially removes the mechanical how-to from you and gets you back to, do you have a good story? And it's sort of an alarming moment, because if you find out, and this is one of the disheartening things that you have to get past, if you find out that your plot just isn't powerful enough to be sold, it's your opinion too. Not just their opinion. You're like, the point A to point B isn't drastic enough. It isn't meaningful enough. I'm trying to get, 10 million people to give me $15, or 100 million people to give me $15. It better be a big difference between point A and point B. And it doesn't have to be a physical thing. It doesn't mean like I started out on a farm on Tatooine and I ended up on, some other planet having blown up the Death Star. It doesn't have to be a physical gap. It just has to be some sort of, I felt this way and I had an understanding of the universe at the beginning of the script. The protagonist has some likeness to me. I feel myself sympathizing with and empathizing with the main character because I have a commonality with that main character. And as the main character evolved with the support team around them, I also evolved and matured sitting in the audience. And that's your job. That's why you have to observe humanity. That's why you have to be a student of philosophy, in my opinion. I don't say you have to go out and read every book on every philosopher, but any drastic paradigm shift in thinking that has affected you in your lifetime, be it you went through a trial and tribulation of your own, or you read a story about a real life situation, you want to fictionalize it, or whatever. You're here to enlighten and give dimension to other people's lives, to make them walk out of the theater and see themselves differently, to perhaps see the light inside themselves and the strength inside themselves that they never saw before. That's the beauty of the nature of what you're doing. You are an artist of emotion. But you must tell the story on screen, and it must be told in absolute, portrayal fashion. When you have kids, it's a very interesting process. Prior to having children, your life is pretty much your own. When you get married, you have a spouse, and you start sharing your tasks with your spouse, right? You might have a real myopic view of life, and I want to watch the shows I want to watch. I want to go to the movies I want to go to. I want to eat at the places I want to go to. I want to vacation the places that I want to go to. And the second that you have a spouse, you start sharing those. And hopefully, if your compatibility is really high, maybe 60 to 80% of what you do is what you want to do. And the other part, you learn to surrender to your mate. And when you have children, you really surrender. In fact, you might surrender damn near everything to your kids until they get to a maturity level where they start to want to do the things that you do. Now, you shouldn't lose your own identity when you have your kids because you're trying to inspire them the entire time. But now imagine that character chart I told you. It's sort of the inverse formula when you're building your characters. You want to bring supporting characters into your character diagram that are going to augment your character that it's connected to. Now, obviously, there are plot twists and things where, you have a best friend of your main character who happens to work for the bad guy. And so there's a duality. And your best friend didn't know that this was going to, that his boss was going to be your enemy, your character's enemy, right? And so they have this tumultuous moment where it's like, I can't believe you work for that guy. I freaking hate that guy. And the buddy says, well, I took the job like 5 years ago, man. I had no idea you guys were going to have a moment in the last 2 weeks that was going to make you arch enemies. I got to pay the bills. And if you want me to change my career, I'm going to have to look for another job and try to find comparable income and data. It's like there's all of a sudden this tumultuous dimension between the two of them, right? Obviously, you would never want to lament on like that in some exhibitionistic dialogue. But however you can bring out that change is there. But now, any of you have a spouse or a kid or a friend that you really, really commit to, they will have you go on paths that you would not have normally gone on. And having gone on that path with that person, it increased your view of the world. You thought you hated something until you tried it. Almost every American on planet Earth, besides maybe the recent kids today, when you were offered sushi, it freaked you out. You're like, what are you kidding me? This isn't even cooked. It's slimy. It's weird. It kind of melts in my mouth. It's gushy and strange. And depending on if you take your friend to a bad sushi restaurant or a good sushi restaurant, that could even be more insurmountable. But if you start eating it, you start realizing, oh my God, this stuff is delicious. Why the hell does it cost four times as much as all the other food in the world, right? But you might realize it's the finer side of life. And that's what your characters have to do for your main character. Centrally located and stemming from the genetics of your plot. Your character doesn't need to learn a damn thing unless it increases the boon of their capability of getting from point A to point B in your plot. Anything that's not related to that is just flush it down the toilet, delete the scene, and if you can, delete the character. Find a better way. I guess I should close by saying a little bit about on-point dialogue and on-point action. When the San Andreas vault situation I've talked about, where the character gets literally stopped by a crack in the ground. Now, if I said to you, I'm going to write this incredible movie about a bunch of people trying to survive a major earthquake, pick wherever you want that to happen on planet Earth, don't you kind of immediately think about that cheesy-ass cliche of the ground ripping apart? And your characters being stuck on one side or the other side. Hell, they did it in Star Trek or Star Wars Awakening, where the ground splits apart, separating the protagonist and the antagonist from each other. Kind of a Deus Ex Machina character to keep them from killing each other. Loosely explained by the fact that this third Death Star, which is 10 times bigger than the other Death Star, has a planetary surface on it, right? You have had a moment in your life where you have learned something very, very profound. And what you learned was not blatantly explained to you. And usually, I'm just going to leave you with this example. Usually one of the low-hanging fruit areas where you learn something profound is when you learn the value of life. And it comes to you in the most illogical ways on earth. Now, if you're going to do an on-point moment to teach someone the value of life, as a writer, you're not going to think of the one I'm going to show you because you're not uneducated about this. But someone who's brand new to writing might say, a person comes up to your main character and just explains the value of life. Look at the flowers. Let's smell that. Look at the infinite sky. Isn't it? Don't you feel wonderful in this 72 degree breeze right now? Isn't that just boom? And they're just right on point of telling you everything you should be appreciating right now. But how do we really learn about the value of life most often? Somebody dies. The inverse formula of what you're trying to learn or what you're trying to teach your main character or expose on film is the inverse of what actually teaches them about the point. The irony of, man, it took death to teach you about the value of life. The best gaps on planet Earth are pure concentrated irony. One of my favorite movies on planet Earth for learning about the value of being alive and sentient is the Robert De Niro movie Awakening. It's about Robert De Niro's character who was stuck in a coma due to a vaccine he got for a different illness. And there's this theory that Robin Williams comes up with, they administer a drug and they can actually wake him up completely. And he goes from being frozen, catatonic, almost paralyzed in a weird form, to being completely sentient, completely mobile. And Robert De Niro's character enjoys life for the very first time since he was a kid when he got this vaccination. And Robin Williams, observing how the most minute thing in life, because this guy has been catatonic, this is a true story, by the way, he's been catatonic since he was a child. So last time he experienced life, he was a child, but now he's a man, at least in his late 40s, in this film. And De Niro's character keeps telling Robin Williams, you guys don't appreciate life. I watch you, and you just go to this mundane machine that is your life. You're not really living, you know? The film doesn't have an antagonist. It's a person. The film has a disease that's the antagonist that sits like a shadow over Robert De Niro's character. And if you haven't seen the film, it is Robert De Niro's most amazing film I think he's ever done. And man, has he ever done some amazing films. As he portrays the collapse of the treatment, when the treatment starts to wear off And no matter how much the dosage he gets, his body is rejecting the drug as creating a neural difference in the mind, because that's what the body does, right? And he starts going back under, and then he knows he's going back under. He knows he's about to lose this amazing gift of life. And Robin Williams, it might be one of his best roles he's ever done in his life. I think I might just say it's his best too. He observes this decline in this character's life. And they both come away knowing that even though he will never communicate with De Niro's character again, that they both understand each other completely. But it revealed the dimension of a kid who was in a coma, catatonic. I guess he didn't have dreams and he didn't know what was going on. He just absolutely gets shut off like a switch. But it also reveals this unbelievable massive heart, which was part of the native heart of Robin Williams as a human being. But he got to play pretty much himself as a doctor taking care of this patient. It's heart-wrenching, but it's beautiful at the same time. The whole film, between point A and point B, it's one of those snake eating its tail thing. You start out with De Niro in a bed in a coma, or a catatonic, or however you want to call it, and at point B, he's back in that bed. But the journey they took was a full circle of life and appreciating the dimensionality of their individual beings as they shared it, right? I think you feel me. Make sure your story outline is solid. Make sure you understand the difference between your premise and your story. Make sure every single character in your character chart absolutely has to exist. Otherwise, you should cut them and combine maybe any essential things that you think needs to happen for your main character into another character. Try to reduce and optimize the people in your scripts. Learn metaphor and irony. The most unlikely thing on planet Earth to teach your character exactly what they need to know is probably where you should gravitate. Create a gap chart for your protagonist and a gap chart for your antagonist. If you want to do a little bit of math, like I said, I do about 48 scenes in every script, divided into perfect fourths, right? If you take my script I was talking about, where my teacher said, you know, look, you probably need 25 to 30 turns/gaps for your main character, then think about that as a little bit of a chart. Two-thirds of the 48 scenes that are in your film need to relate to the gaps that get your character what they need to get to point B. So probably two out of three scenes, as you keep going up or down your outline, should be related to a direct turn that moves either the protagonist or the antagonist closer to their goals. And obviously they're opposed if there is an antagonist, right? Every character, especially your main characters, have to demonstrate who they are by making decisions under pressure. And that's a gift from God when you think about it in terms of formula. I got another episode coming about story, and hopefully it's decent. I'm going to evaluate it quite a bit before I actually release it to make sure it actually survived the continuity of thought that this previous episode did not. I know this one's long, but hopefully it stuck together a lot better, and hopefully the images help out. What I might do is on the Facebook and the WordPress site, mkultraradio.com, I'll try to post the diagrams that I overlay in this particular episode for those of you who are coming through audio only. Which brings me to the bumper. If you haven't been to mkultraradio.com, we've made some improvements. There is now a separate channel on iTunes for Deep Thoughts. And there's a separate channel for MKUltra Radio, the other show. The website's named after the original property, just out of coincidence. So they're two completely different shows. Again, if you're coming through audio, there's video on YouTube. If you're coming through video and you'd like to have this in your car, you can go straight to the website and either use your podcast reader or your iTunes to get it to happen. I did figure out a way to increase the feed on iTunes to include 100 of the last episodes. So I think I believe they allow up to 300. I'll probably reset that as well so you can have them all. So that should greatly increase the effectiveness of iTunes for you guys. We have created another YouTube channel for the MKUltra page. I don't think many of you know about that show. Completely different, topical show. Two guys, you know, rattling on, being very inappropriate on microphones. There's no video for that. There's video, but it's just a plate. So if you want to listen to those on YouTube, you can now. It's a separate link. But go to MKUltraRadio.com. There's Deep Thoughts, the channel, where you can look at everything on there and listen to them right off your right off the website. Again, there's the podcast, the YouTube, and we now have those for the NK Ultra. So anyway, I hope you're having a great day. I hope you're riding sparks from this. Again, if you're having any blocks, just maybe go back and listen to all the episodes I have, which are three. A fourth is coming. So take care of yourself and somebody else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.